Okay, I'm going to open this hearing. Today is March 22nd, 2011. This is the House Subcommittee on Higher Education. I'd like to welcome you all here for a very exciting conversation we're going to have about extending opportunities to foster youth and also a very important housekeeping bill relating to the Office of Degree Authorization. And so I'm going to first open the public hearing on House Bill 3471, and Anna, our committee administrator, will explain what this bill is and does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3471 requires state institutions of higher education, community colleges, and Oregon Health Science University to waive tuition and fees for current or former foster children under 25 years of age. Specifies foster children enrolled at post-secondary institutions as undergraduates may receive an award no later than 3 years after removed from care or conferred high school diploma. Students to receive award for equivalence of 4 academic years. Expands the scholarship program to include current foster children. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Anna. Okay, before we call up the first panel, I just want to say this is a bill that I'm one of the two chief sponsors of. It's very important to me, and it's important to me for two reasons. One is that it's consistent with a lot of the work that we're doing this session, trying to extend more opportunities and access to young Oregonians to higher education and to better lives for themselves and their families. The other is in the last legislative session, 2009, I was on the House Healthcare Committee, the House Human Services Committee, and the House Education Committee. And being on all three of those committees, I found myself getting to know a bunch of foster youth advocates, people who were coming in to let us know about the challenges that they face, the talents that they bring, and the particular challenges that they face as they're transitioning out of foster care and are becoming independent. So when advocates came to me last summer with a request to work with them on this issue, the idea that the high cost of tuition was creating obstacles for foster youth because, well, you know, foster youth are our children, and they don't have, you know, in most cases, parents who can help them navigate the process of applying for financial aid and applying for college and getting through college and helping to pay for college. So that's our job. And to that end, I'm very excited to be bringing this bill to you. You're going to hear more details about it from one of the advocates. There will be some amendments to the bill, and there may be some ideas that come out of our conversations today that will lead to further amendments. But I really look forward to this conversation, and I'm really glad so many people are here. With that, I'm going to call the first panel up, and this panel includes the Honorable Representative Jim Thompson, Sam Jones, and Jamie Hinz, please. And Representative Thompson, would you lead off?
Thank you. Co-Chair Denbrough, Co-Chair Johnson, I'm very pleased to be here today, and thank you for sponsoring this bill. For the record, I'm Jim Thompson, State Representative from House District 23, and I think I could safely be called a foster program advocate. I've been working around it for years. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3471 that would provide state higher education funding for foster children, teenagers, who age out of the system with little or no resources. I've worked with foster teenagers for many years, and one unfortunate fact has become very apparent. We are not good at transitioning these people out of the system. Things have improved in the past few years. The institution of the Independent Living Program has helped, but only about 40% of teens are served by these programs, and many of those are teens from the rural areas that are not served at all. There is still a tendency for teenagers to age out of the program and be dropped between their 18th and 21st birthday. There is simply not enough opportunity for these people to get the support they need to be successful. The result is some very grim statistics. 24% of foster kids have no high school diploma, compared to 7% of the general public. Only 6% earn a college degree, compared to 29% of the general public. 48% are currently unemployed, compared with 76% of the general public being employed. 85% earn 25% or $25,000 or less, compared to 67% of the general population. And it goes on and on. 68% of women receive food stamps, only so compared to 7% of the general population. 81% of the men from foster care have been arrested, compared to 17% with the general population. 59% of foster care men have been convicted, compared to 10% of the general population. These statistics go on and on. The bottom line is that too many foster kids are ending up in the penitentiary, and not enough of them are ending up in college. An investment in college pays off for the future. The penitentiary route is just another ongoing expense for the state. We need to take action to change that dynamic and give these people more support and direction. A young man I worked with for a number of years, a person who had been removed from his family at age 10 and rotated through 12 foster homes by his 19th birthday, commented to me in a conversation, as bad as life has been with his biological family, he had come to realize that the worst parent in the state of Oregon is the state of Oregon. Now, that might be some exaggeration, but it certainly gives us reason for pause. We need to change that. We need to step up to the plate and help these kids, teenagers, young adults, become more successful and better prepared for life. Thank you. And if there's any question, I have to rush off to another hearing, so I'll leave if there's no questions.
Any questions for the representative? Thank you very much for those eloquent remarks.
The people I want you to talk to anyway, so.
Thanks, Jim. Sam? Please identify yourself for the record first. Thanks.
Yes, for the record, my name is Sam Jones. I'm here in support of House Bill 3471. And I want to thank the co-chairs and the members of the committee today for hearing us. I represent a foster youth advocacy group called Oregon Foster Youth Connection, and currently got elected yesterday as president. But life is a transition. For many, foster youth can identify with this. Adapting to an ocean full of life changes is very influential to our success. But many of these doors to success, and in the light of personal and educational finance, are closed from the start. The chances given to foster youth are governed by their unique network of people, i.e. foster parents, caseworkers, attorneys, etc., and the general public. Suppose this was your support group, and as you are transitioning to adulthood from foster care, these are some things to think about. College, money, family, food and shelter. There are many people working hard to see that foster youth are aware of college and financial aid. Depending on the rates of failed out foster parents and homes, foster youth are faced with a monumental challenge. That is to say, in order to go to college and be successful, we must have the necessary skills. Budgeting and managing personal and educational finance, depending on how we are all raised and what we can be given upon aging out, will also determine this. We get one chance with no chance for mistakes. Ultimately, supporting this bill, HB 3471, we will be upholding the futures of our Oregon foster youth for years to come. I feel that vesting an interest in supporting this bill will be a lower cost now compared to a higher costing future. Every year, many foster youth age out of care and are dependent on welfare. We wish to redefine the statistics that say 50% or more foster youth are incarcerated upon exiting foster care, and how our ever-growing interdependence on the adult welfare system increases every year. We hope you will aid us in our efforts. to lead healthy and productive lives. Thank you for hearing us today, and I hope you will support this bill.
Thank you, Sam. Jamie?
Yes. Hi, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jamie Hintz, and I grew up in the Oregon foster care system as well. And I'm an advocate for foster youth and alumni, working closely with the Oregon Foster Youth Connection. And I emphasize access to higher education, which brings me here today in support of House Bill 3471. Thank you for allowing me to speak on behalf of my brothers and sisters in Oregon's foster care system, some of which are in this room with us right now. I'm currently a student at the University of Oregon with plans to graduate in the summer, and the past 5 years that I've been an undergraduate have been a real struggle for me as a former foster youth, in the same ways that it has been a struggle for other foster alumni attending college. I worked two jobs during my first years in college, barely having time to cultivate meaningful relationships with students in my dorm. I couldn't leave during school breaks because I had those two jobs, and if I left, I would have lost those jobs. And I wasn't told until the last minute that the dorms closed, so I scrambled to find a place to stay. And I just don't think that any student should have to worry about that kind of thing while they are, you know, ignoring the task at hand, which is getting good grades. My grades suffered as I tried to pay for them, and I settled for lower grades since the university wasn't kicking me out, so I figured as long as I could keep that up and paying for it, then I would be okay. And just as the economy crashed, I was considering dropping out since tuition was taking a toll on my bank account, and I knew I was fortunate to have two jobs while the economy was really low, or really bad. My experience was normal for young people leaving foster care for college, and most foster alumni would have dropped out. Many don't even apply for college because they know that they will face these challenges. I knew that I would struggle in college since college is really for young adults with supportive families. And I applied anyway in hopes that I could somehow find a way to survive and make it easier for my brothers and sisters aging out of foster care. And one strategy in doing this is creating tuition waivers for foster alumni. This has been a goal of mine since I started advocating and realizing that the cost of tuition is the most common barrier to higher education for foster youth. Creating this waiver will support foster alumni in the same way that parents support their students. This waiver not only breaks down one major barrier to accessing higher education, but also relieves the many challenges that foster alumni face and those challenges that snowball after the initial efforts to pay for college. Furthermore, this waiver will also contribute to lower retention, which is a reasonable concern when talking about when contemplating the education of underserved students. During the past 2 years, I have actually been working at the University of Oregon really closely to create a mentor program, and the mentor program reaches out to organizations in the community, and that mentor program answers to that retention rate for foster youth. My efforts have resulted in a mentor program attached to an existing one at the UL, at the University of Oregon, and it's called IMPACT. And IMPACT stands for Intercultural Mentoring Program Advancing Community Ties. IMPACT already serves some foster alumni. Unfortunately, I didn't find out about it until after my efforts started to create the program. And by expanding to reach out to more foster alumni, they will be able to reach out and provide services mentoring specific to their needs, which answers to their retention rate. IMPACT has been a champion in mentoring university students. The average GPA of a freshman involved with IMPACT is 3.31. This is comparable to the average GPA of freshmen at the University of Oregon who are not involved with IMPACT, which is 2.92. Furthermore, the average overall GPA of students involved with IMPACT is 3.25, which is comparable to the average overall GPA of University of Oregon students, which is 3.04. Not only is the success of IMPACT exemplified through the grades of the students they serve, but the program also provides positive and safe environment for students to cultivate meaningful relationships, which is one thing that I found that many foster alumni view as extremely important when making that transition into independence. If House Bill 3471 passes, the University of Oregon IMPACT program plans to have foster alumni join IMPACT in order to receive the waiver. And in doing so, being part of the program, they will be required to serve at least 5 hours of community service. And since we're conveniently located in Eugene, those hours can be done at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to help relieve that extra burden and administrative costs for this waiver. I came up with 5 hours just because when I went through the work-study budget, that's usually the minimum amount that students have to work for work-study to receive that extra financial aid. Finally, the worst part about being a college student from foster care is watching my peers on campus with their families. Parents help move them into their dorms. They take them grocery shopping. Moms call my friends all the time, making sure they have enough money for rent. And when my roommates are low on cash, who do they call for to help them out? Is their family and their parents. If I've learned anything from college, it's the very valuable lesson that families stick together. And as legislators of Oregon, you are also legal guardians of foster youth, which means that you are our family. So while my peers can call their parents at any time they need help, I have to wait every 2 years to ask for help, which is exactly what I'm doing today, asking my family to help me pay my tuition. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, both of you, for that testimony. I have a question just following up, Jamie, on what you were just saying. We are planning an amendment to the bill that will require actually 30 years. 30 hours out of the year, out of the academic year, in service sort of payback that the foster youth will do, ideally mentoring, you know, high school students, helping get them into the pipeline, showing the way to apply for financial aid and to, you know, just be successful, make that transition. Does that seem like a reasonable kind of commitment to you both?
I think that's an excellent idea, and I prefer that to them simply receiving a tuition waiver without, you know, giving back, and it also gives them the opportunity to cultivate those skills. If I can work two jobs and go to school, they can definitely commit to 30 hours per year to give back to this wonderful tuition waiver.
Great, thank you. Question, Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, just to get on the record, since you're the sponsor of the bill, as I understand it, just the summary of the bill is that this will provide free college tuition for all foster children, correct?
Ultimately, yes.
Yeah, okay. And then question. So Sam and Jamie, I love your stories. You've been in my office, and these are incredible stories. And I think part of what makes your stories so compelling is the struggle that you've gone through, the work in the two jobs, and I think that's what has helped you become what you are, very productive and good, outstanding citizens. I have somewhat of a concern that I think that this amendment will address, and that is getting something in return for getting, or giving something in return for getting this, and I think that's something that that is very beneficial, that will make the bill even a lot better. I like to hear the struggle testimony that you've given. It reminds me of my college years of year as well. All my friends went home for Christmas. I didn't have any parents to go home to either. I stayed over Christmas. I didn't have anybody to turn to for groceries when my roommates were going out for groceries, and I had work. I remember one summer working three jobs as well. And I think that those experiences help me say, I want to become this. I'm here right now, but I want to become this. And because of the struggle I was going through, it helped me really raise my sights and strive to become something even more, to be a productive and self-reliant and independent person. And so I really compliment the amendments that we hope to be seeing that will help give something in return. I guess one question that I have, or I'd like to have you comment on, is are there some other things that you can think of that you can tell me that have helped you become what you are today, besides that? Tell me a little bit more about your struggle that has helped you become what you are today, and many of your fellow students behind you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsay, and this is Jamie again for the record. One thing I know that has helped me become who I am today before you is my relationship with other foster youth, as I've been advocating and working on things just like this. It's just kind of feeling that sense of unity and that sense of being a part of something that's bigger than myself, which is another reason why I'm really excited to start this mentor program for foster youth, because I want them to feel the same thing, that they're a part of something and that they're not an outcast from society, and that it's okay to come forward and really, you know, identify as a foster youth or as a foster alumni, which is a huge struggle for a lot of foster youth. It's embarrassing. We don't like to say that we're foster youth. We don't like to say that we grew up in Oregon's foster care system. So for me, it's definitely relationships that I've, you know, built with these other people in my life, and through mentoring other foster alumni at the university. That feeling of giving back and making sure that I am helping my community in some way has really helped me become the person that I am.
Thank you. Further questions? This panel?
Oh, I was just going to comment. Oh,
please. Thank you, Sam.
For the record, my name is Sam. Yes, thank you, Senator Lindsey, or Representative Lindsey. To comment on this, I would say definitely the most impactful, well, the reason why I'm here today, for instance, is because of a lot of the connections I've been making in the past year with identifying with who I am, and that is an Oregon foster youth. And that has taken a lot of time and energy to really identify with that, because as Jamie has said, you know, you can feel embarrassed or, you know, just really tense about that whole situation. You know, bringing it up in casual conversation isn't exactly, you know, ideal, I guess. But I would say relationships and establishing them with just my community and knowing what struggles I've been through has really forced me to see the gift of reciprocity, and that is, in order to adapt to a given adversity, you have to be flexible, and we have to listen to each other in order to get things done, and we have to help one another so great things like this can happen for us. But I definitely have to say that just the sense of community that has grown on me for the past year has really influenced me to come here today and, you know, support this bill and countless other bills that I'll be advocating for in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. Rep. Hoyle.
I want to thank you so much for coming here. My exposure to young people aging out of the foster system was through the HOPE program at the United Way of Lane County, where it's a mentorship program for young women aging out to connect them for a three-year mentorship program with successful businesswomen in our community. And I can say, honestly, I never realized the difficulties and the obstruction and the what foster youth had to go through just to be successful. And I think, one of the things that we talk about here is that the best tool for someone to be successful, for someone to achieve financial stability, for someone to achieve success in their life is access to higher education. I talked to my sister this weekend, and she was going to my parents' house to have dinner and do laundry, and she's 42. So foster children don't have that opportunity, and as you said so well, we as the state have stepped in, and we are that family, and I think that we do have a responsibility to invest in those of you who actually manage through incredibly, incredibly difficult circumstances to make it to the point that you can access higher education. And I just want to say you're two of the most impressive people that I've ever heard testify since I've been here, and I would love to be able to support this bill.
Thank you. May I comment?
Go ahead.
Thank you. So something that has really kind of caught my attention in regards to financial or social or any sort of stability regarding foster youth has been the sense of stability. And, you know, many years, however many years of foster youth has been in care, that that tragedy or that adversity that happened, you know, has faced them with challenges. And really, when the mindset of stability is brought into play in terms of when you age out or transition out of foster care, becoming stable isn't exactly, you know, the easiest process. And what I mean by this is being familiar with what it is to live an unstable life for a certain amount of years and transitioning into becoming a self-sufficient, independent person is especially difficult because of what we're familiar with, what we're used to hearing from our various representative people, you know, like DHS, governs a lot what happens in our lives. And so when we go into adulthood, making crucial decisions and big decisions, they definitely pose that challenge that it brings up that what-if moment again. So when we are faced with stability, you know, it's great, it's happy, we're doing good, but it's also, you know, something that we have to, another adjustment that we have to get used to. So I don't know if that offers any perspective, but yeah, thanks.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, quick question.
Yes, Jeff Johnson. Jamie, I don't remember if you mentioned this in your testimony. If you did, I apologize. But in addition to working hard, which you have done, have you received any grants that have helped you in your career, whether it be a Pell Grant, Oregon Opportunity Grant, that sort of thing?
I received the Oregon Opportunity Grant and Pell Grant. The more you go to school, the less grants you get. and I know I did some work at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission at the beginning of the year, so I know that the amount of money that's going into those grants is going down. And just the more we progress, the less money there is for foster youth to go to college.
Would you be able to quantify approximately like what percentage of your tuition's been covered by grants? Do you have any general idea? I wouldn't.
Probably about 5%.
Oh, very small then.
Yeah, very
quite small. Okay.
Yeah, definitely don't depend on grants to get me through college.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Sam and Jamie.
Thank you.
Okay. Now I'd like to call up Dee Dee Hartley, Nicole Stapp, and Pamela Butler, please.
We have a quick replacement for Nicole, and she'll introduce herself in a moment.
Great. Welcome, all three of you.
Hi, my name is Bethany Dunn, and I'm here on behalf of my sister, Anna Cash. She couldn't make it. I'm asking your support today for this bill as it can change lives. My name is Anna Cash. I was in foster care for 8 years. I had always planned to go to college and start a business and was excited. I did all the FAFSA and applied for OSAC, toured the college, and it was the first year CHAFE was available. I was eligible for the full $5,000 grant. I started Mount Hood Community College the same June I graduated high school. It was fun and exciting. I had yet to finish my business degree due to lots of bad luck at every turn. It starts with proving that you are a ward of the court. Paperwork that is acceptable to FAFSA or OSAC was not accepted by the college. I had to show how I was living and had no income for the past year when I completed my financial aid. It was like it wasn't understood that I had lived in foster home that had paid my expenses the year before, even though they had checked that box for the situation. This caused my financial aid to be dispersed late several times, because then it was never noted on a permanent record with the college. I would try to apply for book loans. This did not always work, or I had to wait for weeks, and it began to affect my classes already. I had to drop out completely because it was into the ninth week and I had no money. This money was not just for tuition, but it also helped pay my rent, food, car, light, and cell phone bill, and gas, even though I did have a part-time job. Another term, I was hit by a 15-passenger van. This caused me to miss work and school. I was forced to drop out of the school term and lost my job, almost losing my housing. I had to file an appeal to get back in. This caused delays in my aid. I have always had to work to make ends meet, even with financial aid. At one point, my schedule was 2 hotel jobs, Friday from 12 to 8, then 11 to 7 a.m. The next job was Saturday from 8 to 11 p.m., and then Sunday from 11 to 7 on Monday. So she got up, ended at 7 a.m., and then she had class at 9 a.m. on the same day. Of course, I caused myself to get extremely sick and then again was hospitalized. This too delayed my school and made me change jobs. Another term, I was hit again by another car and had to withdraw from school and lost my job due to attendance. It was a bad year. After losing work, you cannot receive unemployment and attend school, so how was I to pay for everything? It became a hard choice, but you have to go with the fastest money. I am now only 4 credits short of completing my college degree. It still seems like 1,000. I am not in school because I cannot afford to go. I have had my car repossessed 3 months ago and was almost evicted 2 months ago. My dog of 2 years died 2 weeks ago, and it's sad when I look back on my goals and see that they may never happen. College, a great job, and a stable home. Free tuition would have helped me be on a whole different track by now. With your support in passing HB 3471, young people could concentrate on school and be productive peers in society. Nobody would go through what I'm going through, and to have your goals so close yet so out of reach. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And please extend our thanks to your sister.
Greeting, members of the committee. My name is Dee Dee Hartley. Today is my 21st birthday, which is also my official last day of being in the foster care system. The last 20 years of my life has been spent in the foster care system. I am a student at Portland Community College. If I had aged out of care at 18, I wouldn't have finished high school, much less have gone to college. When I get asked what it's like to be in foster care, I respond saying, "What is it like not to be in foster care?" I have been in foster care so long, I don't really know what it's like to live any way else. Foster care has its ups and downs. Most of my experiences have been for the worse, and I wish I didn't have them, but I wouldn't be where I am today if I hadn't had them. So far, I haven't experienced the true freedom of aging out since I just aged out. My experience in going to college was exciting. I had a bit of a rocky start because I didn't know I was accepted until a month before the fall term started. I had to move placements a few months after I applied, and I didn't get my mail. This affected my financial aid. Most cases are closed after a youth graduates high school. Youth may not have a stable place to live or a place to receive their mail from. I requested that my case stay open, hoping for a stable living environment that I didn't really get. Fortunately, I was able to get into college that term and got a 3.5 GPA for the next year. Getting tuition waivered would have helped make the grants I got go further. Please support House Bill 3471 so that other foster youth can get the opportunity to go to college and make their lives better. Having the opportunity to go to college and getting a job will help them to be successful and break the cycles of abuse and neglect.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dee Dee. And on behalf of the committee, I want to wish you a happy birthday. What an amazing coincidence. And I would invite the committee to join me in singing a little happy birthday. Everyone in the room.
That's a good idea. Okay.
You do the first verse.
Yeah. Ready? One, two, three.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Dee Dee. Happy birthday to you.
We'll come back to you, Dee Dee.
There'll be another round.
Pamela.
So, Chairs Dembro and Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Pamela Butler. I am the Policy and Outreach Associate for Children First for Oregon, but as most of you probably already know, I'm also an alumna of foster care. I aged out of foster care in Oregon after 11 years in the system and was never adopted or achieved permanency in that way. I am obviously here in support of House Bill 3471, which creates a fee and tuition waiver for youth aging out of foster care at age 18 or up to 21. As you've heard, the bill ends at 25. You'll no longer receive that aid, and you have to apply within 3 years of aging out. As you've heard from Representative Dembro, there are some amendments that we've discussed, and I just wanted to update you on them here. The first would require the recipients of this tuition waiver to complete a minimum of 30 hours of service to their communities per academic school year. So that would be the three terms, or depending on what institution they're in, but we rounded it to a 30-hour overall. The other amendment would make it a last dollar bill so that you would apply for FAFSA and your Pell Grant and Oregon Opportunity Grant would go towards your tuition and fees, and what was left over would then be waived. It does not include the CHAFE money that comes in from the federal government, because it's my hope and our hope that that can be something that youth can use for their books, for their housing, because the housing is one of the top three barriers that youth face in trying to go to college. You know, you get your tuition covered, but then you're living in your car. That's not the best outcome either. So it's our hope that that money can then be used and spread out to attend to the other needs that youth have. So we know, based on regional studies and national studies, that the top three barriers for youth aging out is lack of financial support, obviously lack of emotional support, and then the housing piece. So I was lucky to get out of foster care knowing that I had supportive adults that I could turn to and that cared about me, and one who's in the room today, my wonderful foster mother. However, between the absolute culture shock of leaving foster care after being in it so long and the continuous financial distress of making it on my own, I had no time or energy to maintain those relationships even once I got out of foster care. And it led to a pretty severe depression that nearly cost me my education and my life. If I hadn't been so overwhelmed with taking more credits than more credits than anyone else is taking, and working and volunteering, I probably could have focused on maintaining some of those emotional relationships with supportive adults that kind of fell to the wayside until my last couple years of college. These relationships, as you heard from Jamie and Sam, are very important, and we know that making a tuition waiver for youth isn't going to solve all of our problems, but if that were the case, then I truly believe that caseworkers and independent living program workers and foster parents could wrap around those youth leaving and actually encourage them to go. You know, your tuition and fees are covered. Let's get you the emotional support you need, instead of not even encouraging it, because we don't know how the youth would ever afford it. So I feel like that will help the community and the systems be able to wrap services better around the kids and encourage them to go. With these amendments, it would also bring the Pell Grant and Oregon Opportunity Grant to the universities and colleges that for youth that otherwise wouldn't have applied. So it might be look like a cost burden on one end, but on the other hand, many of those kids wouldn't even try to go to college because they saw it as too big of a burden, too big of an obstacle that they couldn't achieve. Data from the Orphan Foundation of America, which is a scholarship program that I actually received to go to school, shows that they have a 70% graduation rate. That's higher than any program I've ever heard of. And they offer high financial assistance to youth who've aged out of foster care, and also focus on the relationship aspect of kids going. They send a care package around Christmas. They send birthday cards. They're there for a phone call if you need it. And for a lot of youth, it's turning out, those two things made all the difference, and their graduation rates are astronomical compared to even the general population. So for me, this is really a time to send a really loud and clear message, and I believe Representative Wingard said this best a couple weeks ago, just sending a loud message to the youth that we care and that we want to invest in their future success. So I'm hoping that today that we'll all stand up together and send that message of hope to foster youth aging out today and for years to come. So thank you. Please support House Bill 3471, and I am here for questions.
Thank you, Pamela, and thanks for coming forward. I so much admire your dedication to help other foster alumni like you. And you could do anything, and you're dedicating yourself to this. It's really admirable.
Thank you.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's a red robin around the corner if you want to go sing over there as well.
Thank you.
And they pay
only
a lot
if you,
bit,
only
they
if you
pay
come
a lot
with me.
Better than this job, too.
Pamela, and happy birthday again, Dee Dee. That's great. And Pamela, I appreciate your comments. I had two questions, and that was, number one, could you outline what services are already available to foster children. I know that Pell Grants are available for low income. I was a recipient of Pell Grant, and then there's the Oregon Opportunity Grant. You mentioned Chafee. I wonder if you could explain what other resources are currently available and that you may have taken advantage of while you were going through college. And then the second question is, I'm just assuming, it's like you have a wonderful foster parent, does, when you apply for some of these Pell Grants, for example, does that take any account of foster care parents that might be able to assist? And I guess where I'm going there is, I'm assuming that some foster children are blessed with wonderful foster parents of financial means. I know that my wife's uncle is a foster parent and took care 100% finance of a foster child that he had.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm assuming also that some foster children don't win the lottery and have difficulties with foster parents. I'm wondering if you could address the discrepancy between different foster parent financial situations.
All right. Chair Dembro, Representative Lindsay, those are really good questions. The first one is that the foster parents' finances do not count into the financial aid package when you fill out your FAFSA. So you check the box that you are an orphan, that you are in foster care, and you don't fill out those sections on the forms. If the parents do have the means, a lot of them, many of them will support the youth, but unfortunately, I think most of the youth here would tell you that the foster parents that they were with, they either had been there for a very short time, didn't have a good relationship, wasn't a good home to begin with, or they really were not financially capable of helping them. And there's really no commitment that DHS makes with these foster parents that take teens to say, if this youth stays with you until they age out, will you support them afterwards? There's no commitment beyond that birthday when the case is closed, and some foster parents are eagerly awaiting that day to close the door. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. So I think it sounds like you had a really lucky situation, because I have not met any youth yet whose foster parents are helping them through college. And to your other questions about the services available, if we're talking about financial, it's really the Pell Grant, Oregon Opportunity Grant, and Chafee money. That's really all. There is a former foster youth scholarship that was created in 2001. It was funded only for that year and never again. So that would have been a great opportunity to have some money for foster youth, but it's not been funded since. Other than that, you can go out on your own and you can collect cans. You can apply for local scholarships. But as you know, probably already, a lot of foster youth move homes so often. Teens have a tendency to move homes more often than anyone else in care. Their records get lost for their schools. They get behind in their credits. They lose out on classes. And in the end, they might not have the, even though they might have the ability, they don't have the academic record that would get them scholarships that they might be able to get in the community. I was very, very lucky to have been stable for my 4 years of high school and was able to keep my grades up and have the kind of academic achievements I needed to get outside scholarships to go to college. So as far as emotional support or any of the other supports for youth, if you are involved in the independent living program, you can continue to receive some services through them. If you're in Chafee, I believe, I could be wrong, there are people in the room who know this better than me. And so you can continue to have a case manager and someone who helps you, but a lot of youth don't get that. As we've been talking about all session, only 40% of kids eligible for ILP are getting that service. So unfortunately, that's few and far between as well. So other than that, there really aren't a lot of services for youth who age out.
Thank you, Pamela. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Pamela, you had mentioned a program that had a 70% success rate. What was the name of that again?
They have a specific, it's the Orphan Foundation of America.
Okay.
And it's specifically their sponsored scholarship program. It's a national.
Thank you.
Follow-up.
A follow-up, and I don't know if I have a question in here or not. I might end up with one. What I'm thinking as you talked about that and then talking about the tuition waiver, which of course is a great idea, my concern is I think everybody has talked about the other challenges. It's not just the tuition, the housing, and these other challenges. There isn't a question here. It's a statement, and it's an awkward one, which is I would like to explore the idea of some kind of marrying together of this tuition and some support process, because I think just
putting the dollars there without the other piece for success, I don't know that we're doing a complete service. And I think we need to look at that piece, and I, of course, haven't seen the amendments. I don't know if there's anything that addresses that. But when you talked about that, I started thinking, are the dollars just enough, or is it that support piece that really maybe assures that success a little bit more?
Let me say something about that, and Pamela might want to follow up, and I know we have someone who also will address this. Was it on education last year that we had some... I forget which, there was a college, maybe it was the U of O, or it was Lynn Benton, was it?
Might have been Lynn Benton or Lane County.
I don't know, someone. Mm-hmm. A group that came in and was talking about a program at their college for foster youth, a kind of creating cohorts and support, and they were creating a really high level of success because of those, you know, the mutual self-help and the communication, and, you know, that's something that I think would marry very well with this kind of program. You know, Pamela, were you going to...
Yeah, Chair Dembrough, Representative Springer, that's a really good point. And as Jamie was talking about earlier, one of the things that is kind of bubbling up organically on campuses all around Oregon, especially at the community college level, is on-site support networks. So getting foster youth together, getting them to meet each other, the older ones help the younger ones. And I think there's a lot of great work done at the community college level of making sure there's somebody on campus who's kind of a liaison, who this is the number, this is the person you can call if everything's falling apart. They know the system, they know how to help you. So I know that there's a lot of work being done to get those people on the campus that the youth can call. So that's definitely a good point.
Okay. Yes, Rick Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And to my question, you could weigh in on this as well, since I think you were involved. And Pamela, I've asked this to you. As I look at the bill, trying to understand the definition of it would apply to both current and former foster children, okay? And the way it defines former foster child is individual who for a total of 12 or more months while between the ages of 16 and 21 was a ward of the court pursuant to Oregon blah 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 and in the legal custody of the Department of Human Services. So would this apply to someone who was a foster child at some point in time between these ages but then could have potentially become adopted or become into a supportive family situation? Would this bill, is it written, still apply to those individuals, or is it just to individuals who are still wards of the court, so to speak, or who are, or the state, I guess is what I meant to say, and who are in a current situation where they could be, you know, timed out of the system?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to, Representative Demarel, Chair Johnson, the bill as it stands right now is for youth who age out, you know, after 18 up till 21, and the reason why they say current is because now you can stay into foster care until you're 21 if the things all work out for you to do that, so that you could stay in foster care and then get the assistance and go to college and try and work that out in the transition. As far as adoption goes, I believe it says if you're adopted after the age of 16 that you would qualify for this waiver, because one of the things that we don't want to do is discourage folks from adopting older youth out of foster care, because we all know that that's a huge population that just doesn't get adopted very often. So in no way would we want to discourage kids from finding permanent families and, you know, becoming legally adopted. So it does include the portion about 16 or above. If you're adopted, you will get this waiver.
Okay. Thanks. Appreciate your insight.
Thank you, Pamela. Further questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much, all three of you. Again, Dee Dee, happy birthday. And hope you have some fun things planned. Although I don't think you could top this.
I don't have any right now.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to call up Linda Blanchett, John Wyckoff, and Bridget Burns, please. You want to start, Linda, or how do you want to do this?
I think
John.
John?
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association. And with me today is Linda Blanchett, who's a staff and organizational development facilitator at Portland Community College, who's going to talk more about the work being done at PCC to serve former foster youth and to talk a little bit more about the some of the barriers and the real hardships that that these students face trying to accomplish an education. Our association is currently neutral on this bill, but there's a caveat there. I want to be clear. We really support the goals of what is trying to be achieved here, and our colleges feel very strongly that this is a group that has real difficulty finishing an education for a variety of reasons that you've heard today, and that this is something that needs to be addressed. Our neutral position really comes from the fact that our local boards feel really strongly about having tuition authority and making tuition decisions at the local level, and not having mandates from the state about tuition decisions. So we would generally and have traditionally been in opposition to statewide tuition mandates, but our board felt so strongly that this is an important step for these students that we're willing to say, okay, we're not going to oppose this one because this is a very important issue. So the neutrality really reflects that traditional stance about where tuition decisions are made. So having said that, the other issue that we really appreciate the advocates and Representative Dembro trying to help us address deals with the sort of the last dollar that has been discussed, and that was pretty important to our members, which just means you do apply the two forms of need-based aid that all Oregonians can apply for as they're applying to school: the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the federal Pell Grant. Now, having said that, currently, because of underfunding, only 50% of students in the community college system who are actually eligible for opportunity grants receive one because of lack of funding. And so that's obviously an issue here in the context of this discussion. And so one thing that we would suggest for a possibility in this legislation, and that we hope the committee will look at, is possibly setting aside some of the current opportunity grant money for former foster youth and saying we're going to guarantee that a former foster youth receive an Oregon Opportunity Grant if they meet the eligibility requirements, because currently they would have at best a 50% chance in the community college system of actually receiving the grant. So that's something that we would ask the committee to look at in consultation with the Student Assistance Commission, who obviously would be the experts on the feasibility and how that could possibly be done. But applying the first two forms of aid sort of guarantees to the student that the college will not charge you tuition, and we're trying to guarantee for you that you also get financial aid. So it's telling the student from two parts of the education sector, we have your back. It also, quite frankly, spreads the responsibility for this program, which obviously does not come with funding, between when you apply at last dollar, between the financial aid part and to the colleges. A lot of that, though, is remedied by applying the Pell Grant and the Opportunity Grant first. To us, that was really the critical piece. But we do think it adds, it would be an important statement to students to say, and by the way, you're also guaranteed an Opportunity Grant, that you're going to get that financial aid if you're eligible, because the state is taking responsibility, as these students are responsibilities of the state. So that's something that we would just ask the committee to look at. And I will conclude with that and take questions, and then if anyone should have any, and turn it over to Linda, who can talk about the specific kind of services that exist on campuses and what some of the barriers are.
Thank you, John. And colleagues, I should tell you that we had a little work group a couple of weeks ago. John, Bridget was there, Josette Green from OSAC, and Rep. Wingard, the other chief sponsor of this. And we talked about a lot of these issues, and that's where these amendments came from that we're talking about.
Yes. Chair, is this the Dash 3 and the amendments that you're talking about?
No, that's for a different bill.
Okay.
Yeah, I decided not to have the amendments drafted yet. I wanted to see what else came up over the course of this hearing, and we'll have them drafted and ready for next week. So, Linda, why don't you go ahead? And it's a pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, Linda Blanchett.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank you all for having the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm here specifically to talk to you about the past 14 months at Portland Community College and the efforts that have been put into reaching out to our communities, foster youth, building awareness around the needs of our foster youth community, and how we started out and where we are today. And I think when you hear about this, the synchronicity of this conversation and the moment that we're in today and the past 14 months, the journey that we've had at Portland Community College is really quite remarkable. Our college has a management leadership training program that was instituted by our president a few years ago, in which I have had the honor to work on and be a part of. And part of that leadership training program requires that the participants choose something of service that they would like to do for the college. The cohort that I went through last year decided, we took a look around and we said, you know, isn't it interesting that we're not doing anything specific, really intentionally, deliberately strategic in reaching out to the foster youth of our community? Why don't we explore that topic a little bit more? So we began by doing our research. We spent a lot of time with the Casey Foundation and Casey Family Services in Seattle. They have done some of the most important research and publications that exist today in foster youth, on foster youth challenges and access to higher education. We also went out into the community and we did a scan. We talked to caseworkers, we talked to foster youth, we talked to the independent living program coordinators, and we said, how are we doing? How's PCC doing? And then we went back to PCC and we talked to managers and we talked to Roots and we talked to our Roots programs and TRIO programs and students, and we talked to teachers and we said, how are we doing? How are we doing with our foster youth? And what we found was a discrepancy between how we thought internally we were serving our foster youth and what the community perceived. And the gap was, you're a big institution, and our students get lost, and we're lucky if we get them through the door and through the financial aid process. So that became our project, and that became, we went to our administration, we went to our leadership, we presented the white paper that summarized our research, and we immediately received a green light and a tremendous amount of support from our leadership to go forth and find solutions. And we have spent the past 14 months working on that. So as a result of that initial needs assessment, we began an education process throughout our district. We did presentations for our staff and for our faculty at all of our campuses. We did presentations at managers' meetings. We did presentations at yearly retreats for our student services providers. We had a goal to educate our district, the PCC district, on who are our foster youth, what are our challenges, what can we do to better serve them. In the meantime, we were reaching out to the community and we were creating ties where previously the service providers for foster youth would happen to hear about Financial Aid Day if they were on the right website or looking at the right piece of information. What we did was ask our outreach coordinators at each campus to strategically put it on their calendar. It became one of their goals for every quarter. Every time we have an event now, they are contacting DHS. They are contacting the Independent Living Program. We have created those links between the community service providers and the people in our financial aid offices, our outreach coordinators, and our counselors and advisors. So a dialogue has begun, and a deliberateness about communication and bringing people into the dialogue is happening. As a matter of fact, just this past week, I learned of four events that are happening across the state of Oregon over the summer for foster youth, and I sent that agenda to our outreach coordinators, and it is now on their radar screen, and they will be working at those events to get the word out about financial aid and who we are and how you come to PCC. One of the most exciting things that happened is that we were approached when the word got out that PCC was working on this. We were approached by Portland State University, and I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but the School of Social Work received a three-year grant to do a three-year study of three separate cohorts of foster youth with physical disabilities and emotional challenges to help them access higher education and to track their progress over 3 years. Portland State did their research and realized that the first port of entry for those students was going to be with the community colleges. So they called us and said, can you help us out? And as a result, and I'm now actually serving on that planning board, and as a result of that dialogue, Portland Community College hosted the first ever PCC Day specifically for that population of students to come to PCC, explore their career aspirations, work with counselors, et cetera, et cetera. It was a very successful day, and we have committed to doing one each year for the two remaining cohorts, and I'm actually busy right now planning that. That will happen July 26th of this coming year. Our year of research and communication culminated on February 11th of this past month, where we held a Fostering Success Summit, and I'm extremely proud of this, because when we started 14 months ago, this was an idea. It was a vision. It was a what if PCC were able to bring to the table for one day as many people in our community who are concerned with the welfare of foster youth, who provide services to our foster youth. What if we were to be able to bring them, our foster youth, and the colleges together, community colleges together, to talk about how we can do this better? And that happened on February 11th. We had 120 participants. 30% of them were community providers. We had a panel of foster youth that were there. The rest of the audience participants were made up of mostly PCC, but Mount Hood sent somebody. Clackamas Community College sent somebody, and we spent a wonderful day. We had speakers come from the Casey Foundation. We had speakers come up from California. We had our students present, foster youth present, and we launched what I believe, in my vision, will become a statewide dialogue on how we can serve foster youth. And what I am hoping, and I have received commitment from our leadership, so I know that we'll be doing this coming year, in February 2012, the third Friday, when we hold our second Fostering Success Summit, that we have representation from every community college across the state of Oregon. And what I'm hoping to be able to do in 2 to 3 years is present you with what the community colleges have discovered is a best practices model for the state of Oregon in serving foster youth through in accessing and succeeding in higher education. So I'm very pleased that was as successful as it was, and we did that with a lot of support across the community. There are a number of tangible benefits that have come about as a result of what happened on February 11th. Four of our staff have stepped up and are now completing the Coaching for Success program, which is a program where they are trained in mentoring skills, and they are bringing those skills back to PCC in order to mentor foster youth. And they are doing that through the Independent Living Program. And as it turns out, there's one representative from each of our campuses where our highest populations of foster youth are present. And that was a completely voluntary basis. And that happened after the Fostering Success Summit, because what we've done is educated our district.
I'm going to butt in just for a moment. And that's Bridget, I'm going to ask you if you can hold your testimony for also, because Mark McKinney has to testify, and so I'm going to call him up now.
Okay.
If that's okay, Bridget. Yeah, Mark, why don't you come up? He has to be upstairs to testify somewhere else. So we'll come back to you.
Almost done. Great. Yeah.
Thanks.
Hi.
Thank you very much, Representative Dembro. Chair Dembro, Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We just recently changed our name from the Juvenile Rights Project, and I appreciate you adjusting the schedule to allow me to speak today. We've been around since 1975 and have represented over 50,000 children and youth in the juvenile court system. Over three quarters of our clients are children in the foster care system. I can't express how important this bill is and how long overdue it is. If you haven't been impressed with the need by the testimony that came before, I'm not sure what else I can say to convince you. I think what I can add is a bit more context on the history of this issue, in that we were the organization who drafted the bill that was passed 10 years ago now to create the former Foster Child Scholarship Fund. And unfortunately, it didn't have either the effect or the staying power that we thought it would have 10 years ago, because it wasn't funded beyond the first biennium. At that time, we were hoping not only to help foster youth who were entering college and already in college, but really our thinking was that we needed to inspire and encourage children in foster care who are in middle school and high school and give them realistic hope that they will have the ability to go to college. I think it's very important to set up a system that will be sustainable and predictable so that you can send this message to students who are still in secondary school. Unfortunately, that didn't happen with the first attempt to provide aid to foster youth. I don't want to, and I'm sorry, I forgot to hand up my written testimony before I started, but I will hand it out. But I did want to address a few things that other things that may not have been addressed so far. Another one, unfortunately, in addition to all of the other negative outcomes that you've heard about children in foster care, one of the very unfortunate dynamics that we see in our work, having been around as long as we have, is that we are seeing families that are involved in the foster care system in their second, third, and sometimes fourth generations. And higher education, as you know, is an important opportunity, an important protective factor to change the lives of people, to help make them more successful, and to transmit those benefits to future generations. So by passing this bill, you are not only helping immediately the foster youth who are entering college or who have just started, but you will be helping their children and their children's children break a cycle. And that, frankly, is in the state's own self-interest to do that, because you'll be avoiding having to become the guardian of future generations of children as well. I think it can't be overemphasized that all the different ways and the different ways it manifests itself, that the experiences of life for foster youth are much different. All the little things that many of us took for granted when we were growing up, in terms of the support of our family and all of the things that meant, and the ability to go home when times were tough and to be able to pick up the phone and ask for a little extra money when you're running short, those are all opportunities that are closed to most foster youth who've left the system. And those are the things that help people get through college. I think it's important to recognize many foster youth attempt to go to college because they recognize what an opportunity it presents, but the problem we're seeing is that they don't have the ability to finish once they start, as you've heard from some of the stories so far. And having to delay enrollment, attend only part-time, lacking that financial and other support of a family, and having to work full-time to support oneself. Those are all well-established risk factors in the research that work against a student's ability to persist and graduate from college. This bill addresses many of those risk factors. It doesn't do everything, and I take Representative Springer's point about other types of support that are needed very seriously, but I would also like to point out that I think colleges will recognize the needs of this population only when there is a critical mass of students in college who are former foster youth. Right now, I believe they are invisible to many higher education institutions because there are so few former foster youth able to attend. Once there is a critical mass who are able to attend, their needs will become much more visible and much more obvious. And this bill, the ability to, or the support to make it financially possible to attend college, will help make it so that there are simply more foster youth in college, and then the next step will be to work on some of those other types of supports that are necessary to keep them there and to keep them through graduation. And with that, I will end my remarks. I'm happy to take any questions before I have to leave, and I will hand in my written testimony on my way out.
Thank you, Ms. McKechnie. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Bridger, you can come back up now. Linda, you had a couple more points to finish up.
Where was I? Yes, in addition to our four folks at PCC, four staff members who have become who are becoming coaches, certified coaches, for working with foster youth, we have a commitment from our Roots program. They are going to dedicate one staff person to going out and learning everything they can about how Roots can better connect with the foster youth community. We have two campuses that are working on ideas for setting up foster youth clubs at the moment. Very exciting development. We were contacted by Commissioner Saltzman. This happens to be one of the projects that he is very dedicated to, advancing the status of foster youth in the community, helping them succeed in higher education. And we just had a meeting with him yesterday where we're looking at a one-stop model. What would it look like at PCC if we had a one-stop model where we had a place where our foster youth could come and they could have all of their counseling needs met, financial aid questions met, et cetera, et cetera. So we're looking at best practices, other kind of one-stop models in the city, and we're in that dialogue right now. We have another person, our community relations manager, who is out exploring partnerships with Big Brothers Big Sisters, organizations such as that, seeing whether we could partner, maybe having one of their counselors on our campus. We're looking at all kinds of opportunities. We are in a wonderful dialogue right now with Bridge Meadows. I'm not sure if you're all familiar with the Bridge Meadows project. If you're not, Google it, watch the video. It is a multi-generational foster care community that has been built in North Portland, where families are coming together and subsidized housing is being provided to families who are adopting foster youth. I have toured the facility. I'm in conversation with the executive director, and what she's really excited about and I'm really excited about is creating links between our Cascade campus, because that's the closest campus, to Bridge Meadows. And one of the challenges that foster youth faces, very, very often, foster parents have not been to college themselves, so they don't hear that dialogue of going to college. And we're imagining the what if our Cascade campus served the parents of the foster youth as well as our foster youth. And so we're exploring that right now. And all of this is being tracked throughout the year with the creation of a website at PCC where we're dumping all this information and tracking the various projects and where they're going and the dialogues and the communication. And in conclusion, what I would like to say is I think that the work that we're currently doing at PCC is valuable, not only in as much as we're reaching out to our foster youth and we're talking to them and we've brought the community and the college together and we're in that beginning planning phase, but also because what we're looking at is taking existing programs
things and existing resources and see if we could rewire just a little bit so we increase the radar, so we're serving in a deliberate and intentional and committed manner the foster youth in the community and creating efficiencies in our system. So that's my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Why don't we hold off on that? But Linda, thank you for your work on this, and please convey to your boss our appreciation for his support. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute, he's in the room. President Pulliams, welcome to this committee meeting, and thank you for your support of this program. Okay, Bridget.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bridget Burns. It's an honor to speak to you today. I come to you in support of this legislation on behalf of the Oregon University System. I'm the chief of staff for the university system, for the record. We come at this from a very philosophical standpoint. While we share some of the concerns echoed by, or pointed out by Mr. Wyckoff, in terms of statewide tuition mandates, we believe that there are so many different barriers for these students that this is one that we are willing to take up. And that these are ultimately, these are our children. And I came before this committee earlier this month and testified in support of 529 plans about how we're trying to encourage families to plan for their children's future. And these are our children, and we should be planning for their future just the same. And we believe that it speaks to the values of higher education, where access to post-secondary education is, for millions of Americans, the gateway out of the poverty cycle. And for children who don't have a connection to their families, this is the best opportunity for them to create a compelling future for themselves. And we want to be able to break down as many of those barriers as possible. And we really support a lot of the work that's going on in various higher education communities. Obviously, Linda just talked to you about a lot of the great work that PCC is doing, and they are a tremendous partner. And I also want to point out that I acknowledge that the community colleges will be a primary point of contact for a lot of these students. So while I'm speaking in support, I understand that they will be experiencing greater traffic through the community colleges. Currently, we're serving about 85 former foster youth within our institutions. The only thing I would say is that while this is about financial aid, and it's an important part of this policy, is the last dollar issue, which we've talked about with Representative Dembro, and counting after the Pell Grant and the Opportunity Grant, we think that more than anything, this is about sending a clear message about a college-going culture and convincing people that this is something that is possible and it's attainable, and that it's something that's frankly expected that they will go to college. And so we think that this is one of the many ways we can chip away at the various barriers, perceived and real, that former foster youth experience. We know that there are a lot of things that they experience that others don't. They're frequently triggered in the FAFSA process because it's very difficult. You know, we heavily regulate that process, and so frequently they are triggered, and it doesn't make sense. They have to prove that they're former foster youth. And then we all know that filling out the FAFSA form is incredibly difficult, harder than your taxes most of the time. And so putting that barrier plus being triggered, and then additionally, you know, when there's a holiday break, most people assume that you go home to spend time with your family, and our residence halls, where a lot of these youth would be living, closed down over the break. I mean, they're barrier upon barrier, and so if this is the one that we can focus on, that we can make a dent, we are supportive. And so I would just say that the university system is very proud to support this legislation with the amendments that we've talked about. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Bridget. Colleagues? Yes. Representative Johnson.
Bridget, related to Mr. Wyckoff's comment about setting aside a portion of the Oregon Opportunity Grant for this, would your folks have any perspective or feeling about that?
Co-Chair Johnson, I think that is we would consider that a friendly amendment. Of course, I would point out, though, however, on the same page, we should fully support the Opportunity Grant so that we are not preferencing one student, and then ultimately we still face the problem of students not getting in before their deadline and not getting a full Opportunity Grant. So we support all low-income students, and we think that this is And I think that's an important policy suggestion, because while the higher education community, the institutions themselves, are going to be stepping up and dealing with this the tuition burden for their students, it's important to spread around. These are our students. These are all of Oregon's students, not just the universities or the community colleges. So finding all the community of support that we can build around these students so that they can be the most successful, that's the right avenue. And so I would say amendments like that in concert with policies like this are the best way for us to be able to support these folks.
you, Bridget. Rep. Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if there's something else. I guess first is, I'm wondering if you have some sort of statistic, and maybe you can get it to us later, on graduation rates and retention of former foster students. The second question would then be, if there's something additional that we might be able to assist them to make sure that they do graduate and to relieve any sort of dropout rates.
Chair Dembro, Representative Lindsay, let me take a whack at that, and then I'm going to hand it over to Linda, who is the expert here. But I stole these numbers from Linda. So we got about 70% of the students that we're talking about that are former foster youth will start at the community college. Correct me if I'm wrong. And of those, the rates of completion are very low, and so 3% is the rate of completion there. The barriers start from getting in the door and last the whole way through. And so I think some of the points made today about not just the tuition, but then also that there is sort of a whole array of services that need to be interfaced for these students so that they can actually complete and finish the certificate degree that they're going after. And with that, I would probably turn it over to Linda.
Those numbers are right on because I gave them to you. 70%, 3% graduate with a baccalaureate as compared with 27% of their peers. And if you take a look at the research, no matter what you're looking at, and a lot of it comes out of California, they've done quite a bit of work in best practices in serving foster youth, what you find is that the financial aid piece is one piece. It's critically important. Worrying about where to live in the summer, worrying about where to live. So it can't just be tuition. It has to be monies that are available, and I think Pamela Butler made this point. It has to be monies that are available for books, and there have to be monies available for shelter. And food and clothing, and that sounds very rudimentary, and that's exactly what it comes down to. But in addition to that, higher education institutions have to provide the wraparound services. And I think one of the reasons why a lot of foster youth begin at the community colleges is because we are experts at those wraparound services. We're really, really good at it. And the research has proven out time and time again that what we need to provide is a face that they can recognize. You go onto the college website, foster youth, this is the person you call at Cascade. This is the person you call at this campus. This is the person you call it if you're at Lynn Benton, et cetera, et cetera. So the wraparound services are critically important, and that's why I was asked to speak to you today, so that we could present a picture of the strides that we've made that are going to help support whatever decision you come to, be it the tuition waiver, be it the opportunity grant, whatever it is you end up working through, that's one piece. We're working on the wraparound piece, and we're very excited and poised to work with community colleges across the state to promote that.
Thank you, Linda. You have a follow-up question?
Actually, just a question to you. I haven't been able to find a fiscal impact statement.
Yeah, it hasn't been issued yet.
Okay.
It will be after we do the amendments.
Okay.
So you'll have it in time before the work session, okay. Certainly. Yes, Rep. Hoyle.
And again, I very much appreciate your support and you bringing this forward. And, you know, as you've stated and as the, you know, former foster children have stated, the biggest obstacle is actually getting through the door. And then those wraparound services are critical. What I would like to caution is that, you know, we don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good and have this bill stopped because we haven't got all the wraparound services. I think this is one step, and the other steps are important. In Lane County, we're very lucky in that we have lots of organizations that are working together for those wraparound services. I think Representative Thompson made a good point that we forget that as hard as it is for our foster care children in urban areas, our foster care children in rural areas have even less services. So we really have to think about when we have these wraparound services that we're working with both urban and rural areas. But again, I would just caution that we not
work so hard to make this perfect that we miss this very, very important tool that everyone's saying that would be really valuable.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative. Panel, thank you very much. We have a couple of other people who've signed up to speak. I want to get to those and then move to our next bill. Diane Egger and Martin Rafferty. Oh, I'm sorry, and Marvin Sanis.
I noticed you had corrected it. You were thinking of a song.
Thank you. Okay, who's on first?
Go ahead.
I'm Marvin Sanis. I live in Salem. From 1974 to 1986, I was the executive director of the Willamette Valley Youth Shelter. I worked with about 2,000 kids between 13 and 17. And in that time, I saw several hundred good kids transition to welfare or corrections. Should not have happened. It did happen. After a few exchanging some texts this morning with Matt Wingert, I am shocked and embarrassed as an Oregonian that we have not done this. This is a travesty. Not only is it a travesty for the kids, but this is a no-brainer. The investment, the return, the profound return on our investment, financially and the human return. I mean, this should have been done a long, long time ago. I don't know what we've been doing here with our money, but this is an investment. We'll get our money back right away. So that's my point. And thank you for bringing this. I don't know, where has this been? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sanders.
I'm Martin Rafferty. I'll be brief and somewhat entertaining.
thank you.
Already are.
I'm the director of a youth program that's across the state called Youth Move. We are a transitional aged youth program serving youth 14 to 25. We primarily right now serve youth with mental health diagnoses, and we have teen centers that are starting to serve a lot of homeless youth. 3/4 of the homeless youth that we serve in this transitional age have been in the foster care system. And so when we had the chance to come up here and support this, we jumped at it. On the way up, I saw the impossible signs on billboards, and I looked in my car, and I'm like, I'm glad none of those homeless foster youth are in my car, because they feel like it's impossible. So on behalf of the mental health programs, I know that AMH, Addictions and Mental Health, has a lot of reports on this huge gap between 14 and 25 that when these youth have mental health diagnoses, they go into this gap and they come back to the mental health field through the justice system. So we really support this, and I'm thrilled. It sounds like all of you support it, so I'm not going to take any more of your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Dembro, Co-Chair Johnson, thank you very much, and everybody else for your time today. My name is Diane Egger, and I'm a youth advocate. I've worked with Independent Living for 20 years, the Oregon Foster Youth Connection for 2.5 years, and Greater Metro Foster Parent Association for about 10 years. I've assisted in completing the FAFSA, OSACs, the Chafee Education voucher applications, been in financial aid offices, and filed appeals for years with youth. My goal has always been and encourage these kids that they can go to college, you know, because the money has been there. Money's not the barrier. It's been accessing the money in a timely manner. And that's what this tuition waiver would extremely help with. Even with the Pell, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and Chafee dollars, a young person can't cover all the living expenses. The tuition and fees and books is just a small part, like we've been saying, because most of these youth can claim independent on their FAFSA forms, and that causes many of them to be flagged, as this is unusual for the age under 24. What has become one of the biggest problems is the awards are being delayed and the tuition and books money isn't available at the beginning of their terms. 64% of TAFE applicants have been identified by FAFSA for verification, and this delays the release of all their aid. Anytime a school asks for one more piece of information, the youth's financial aid goes to the bottom of the pile. Information is not always kept on file from term to term or even year to year. Once a former foster child, always a former foster child. This doesn't change. So if something like that could be kept on their record, that would certainly help. The colleges start sending notices that, you know, you have a late payment, you're going to be late, this kind of thing, they start charging late fees. These notices on their PCC accounts, because I'm from the Multnomah County area, and that's one of the largest, you know, colleges most of our kids attend, besides Mount Hood and stuff, they can be quite intimidating for these young people the first time when they're starting getting these late notices. And it's not uncommon for these youth to be scared and even start to withdraw. They'll even go talk to some advisors, well, I don't have my financial aid yet. And they've been told, well, withdraw this term and just wait till next term. I've seen in cases where their financial aid isn't dispersed for 6, 8, 9, even 11 weeks into the term. I've had a case where it wasn't dispersed at all that term, and they doubled it up the next term. How are the youth, let alone covering their tuition, supposed to pay their housing and all the rest of the cost of attendance, like we said, the rest of the worries? That's why with a tuition waiver that's guaranteed for these foster youth, when they still apply for the Pell, the CHAFE, and the Oregon Opportunity Grants, the rest of their cost of living could be covered by the rest of that's coming in, because at least they'd know their tuition is covered the day they start and are accepted into whatever college they go to. Whether it's rural in Douglas, Hood River, Scio, Eugene, wherever they're at, because then they know they could still pay their bills. A lot of these youth, like Sam, Anna's story that you read, they are transitioning from foster care and going out on their own and having their first jobs at the same time. And it's hard to work and go to school and keep up their grades. So also having a tuition waiver and getting the financial aid that's based off need, they could concentrate on school and do well with the wraparound services that could be provided at these places. When they go into the schools and trying to work with these financial aid offices, the runaround is horrendous and even actually deters some of these youth from returning. As we know, they're already a little scared of the system, even though they know they've been turning everything in on time and doing it the right way. The rent doesn't wait for their financial aid check, so that's another reason some of these youth drop out of college. If a young person has to choose between their housing and school, they usually do drop out of school. It's a lot to take on a new home, full-time school, and mostly, like I said, most likely the first job they've ever had. Passing House Bill 3471 and providing tuition waivers does not by any means give these foster youth a free ride. The cost of attendance at an Oregon community college averages between $13,000 to $15,000. $15,000, and the only part of that is the tuition and fees. These young people would still rely on the other funding options, like the Pell Grant, CHAFE. Somebody else asked. There is also the Federal Supplemental Education Opportunity Grant that's available besides the private funds that colleges offer. The OSAC, I know we've been banding that name about. That's kind of like a clearinghouse for...
Yeah, it's both the opportunity grant and then private scholarships as well.
Yeah, it's about 345 scholarships if a youth applies to that. And we usually do make sure all our young people fill out that application to see what they can match them up to. So that's another chance they can apply for things. The tuition waiver would just allow these dollars to go even further as all these are based on needs. The CHAFE, which all foster youth are eligible for, and former foster youth, started out at $5,000 in 2005 and is currently can only be awarded $3,000 because so many youth are receiving that fund now. Currently, we have 196 foster youth using these funds. There is approximately 2,000 current and former foster youth eligible for CHAFE across the state, but only 196 are attending college right now. You know, let's hope that they can all graduate if we can continue these services.
Good. Thank you very much, Ms. Simpson. Any questions for this panel?
I have one question, technical on this. This 16 to, I've been out of this juvenile justice loop for a long time, but I used to see kids apply for emancipation at 16 years old and be granted. I don't know if that's still the case, but if a kid applied for emancipation and was released from the juvenile court, they would not qualify for this, so they decided to go to college a year or two later. Anyway, I'd like to have that raised in your work.
Okay. Fine. The bill does say that they have within 3 years of emancipation or aging out. I think they would be covered.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, panel. And all of you, thank you very much for coming down here and helping us work through this bill. We'll be working on amendments and be moving it to the next level sometime very soon. Thank you for your help.
Okay.
And we have a couple of pieces of testimony to read into the record. Anna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Galen Phillips with the Oregon Network for Youth and the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition has submitted written testimony in support of House Bill 3471. And Valenka Spear with the National Association of Social Workers has also submitted testimony in support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and with that, I'm going to close this public hearing for House Bill 3471. And I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2117. And I'll call up Alan Contreras. He's promised me this is a very simple technical fix. And colleagues, if all goes well, we may be able to work this bill if it meets our satisfaction. Okay, Alan, and then Gary and Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I know that a simple technical fix falls in the category of famous last words. These are, in fact, probably my last words testifying to the legislature, as I'll be retiring next week. So I wanted to try to be here to explain what we're trying to do with this bill. The original House Bill 2117 was intended to do two things. It was the bill into which a merger plan was placed at the recommendation of the staff of the former governor. That merger plan is an idea that's been rattling around out there for a while, which would merge the Office of Degree Authorization with the Private Career School Office in the Oregon Department of Education. That concept currently has no support anywhere, to my knowledge. The Department of Education has expressed the fact that they do not want that to happen. The commissioners for whom I work voted 7-0 a couple of months ago that they don't want it to happen either. And furthermore, Senate Bill 242, which seems to be where the action is this session, would erase and preclude this whole concept anyway and supersede it. So our intent is that entire portion of the bill, which is the bulk of it, simply disappear. And part of your Dash 3 amendments do that. The other portion of the bill was put in there in order to deal with a change in federal law that occurred in November, effective July of occurred in November of 2010, effective July of 2011. And that change would require that any college that wants to be eligible for federal Title IV aid for its students be formally authorized by name by the state that it is in. And Oregon and some other states have not used a system like that. We have authorized one group of schools by category. Those that are regionally accredited have operated in Oregon for at least 5 years and are nonprofits, almost all of which are members of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association, which is why Gary is here on this bill today. Oregon law simply creates a category for them and says you do not have to get a license from the state because of your status. This is mostly schools like Willamette, Linfield, Lewis and Clark, and so on. The original draft of the bill, my idea was to simply list all of these schools by name and say, here, they're authorized by name, you guys would approve the bill, we'd be done. In discussing this with my staff member, Jennifer Diallo, the idea came up from her that it would be a lot simpler if we simply said in the bill that the Office of Degree Authorization shall issue a license to any school that is in this category. That would mean that we would not have to come back to you every session whenever a school changed its name, which one of them did this past year and others may in the future, or when another school met the five-year in Oregon requirement. We'd be here every session asking you to amend that list of schools. And that seemed like kind of a good idea for a change. We did discuss this with our agency legal counsel, who felt pretty comfortable with approaching it that way. So that's what was in the original bill, and then that long list was in the original bill. What we're trying to do with these amendments is to get rid of the merger, which is going to be superseded by 242 anyway, instead of doing the long list of schools, simply make the issuance of a license a shall issue, if you will, by ODA for any school that's in that category. Because the one other thing we are trying to do with the amendments is that ODA is a very rare thing in state government, because there is a statutory provision saying that the administrator of the Office of Degree Authorization shall be appointed by the commissioners. That has always been something of an anomaly. The commissioners and the current executive director would like that one sentence to be removed, and that's also here in your Dash 3 amendments, so that the administrator of the Office of Degree Authorization would be hired the same way that any other agency manager would, and by the executive director of the agency. So what you have in the Dash 3s does those things. It gets rid of that merger. It gets rid of that long list of schools. It says that ODA shall issue a license upon request for schools that are, or not upon request, but for any school that's in that category. And it deletes that one sentence having to do with the commissioners appointing what amounts to a mid-level manager within a small state agency. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Let me just to that last point, Alan. This last point may bring these amendments into some conflict with Senate Bill 242, which moves the Office of Degree Authorization under the new Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. There are amendments that are just being drafted now to that end, and so it may be a potential conflict.
Having not seen those amendments, I can't comment on exactly how they fit together, but you could certainly, one other thing you could do is allow 2117 to die a natural death and simply deal with those same two issues inside 242 in that amendment package. It could be done that way too. The thing that concerns me is to make sure that by July 1, if the bill doesn't go into effect, then there is a 6-month buffer zone there, and we could let the feds know that we were in fact going to be in compliance with that. You can put that in any bill you want to put it in. Mm-hmm. It's just we have this bill as a vehicle.
Is this new stuff? Okay.
We'll come back to that question. That'll determine whether or not we work it today. I'm thinking we may not want to now, just because of this potential problem.
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons that I wanted to bring this today is that it was not clear to me that your committee was ever going to see Senate Bill 242.
That's
why I'm here.
Right. No, I appreciate that. And we may well want to amend this in a way that it won't come into conflict with 242 and pass this out, rather than trying to instill yet another amendment onto 242, which may be complicated. But we can talk about that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think I agree. I mean, the ultimate state of 242, I think, is still much in debate. So I'd be hesitant to do something based on its current status, because what it ultimately becomes could be different in some way. So that I have some reservations about adopting amendments that are specifically targeted towards the bill as it currently exists. So I just throw that out as a qualifier. So, but your point to aligning with federal regulations, I think, is probably valid. At least paying lip service to the ideal. Yes.
Well, let's hear from Gary. Maybe he'll convince
maybe
us
he
that even that is a here. Bad idea, Alan. So,
I didn't get it done, Gary. It's your turn.
Take a whack at it.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Gary Andine. I'm the president of the Oregon Independent College Association, representing all 20 of the regionally accredited nonprofit Oregon-based institutions, including that one right out the window. My principal purpose here today was to support Alan's letter to you and impress on you how important it is that we get this alignment with the federal, with the new federal rule in place by July 1. Having heard the conversation now, I might be able to add a little bit of context, Chair Dembrow. This is my 27th year of doing this job, and my last one, by the way. I'm following Alan out the door 5 months later. Mm-hmm. And I've been probably the one state agency that has taken up most of my attention in a variety of ways has been the Office of Degree Authorization over the last 27 years, because that office does regulate non-state and non-community colleges, and that includes my institutions. It has regulated them in various ways over the years. Currently, we have what we think is a nice, clean exemption for schools having been here 5 years and so on and so forth. And we want to obviously keep that in play. The Office of Degree Authorization started off when I arrived in 1985, it was part of the Oregon Education Coordinating Commission, the OECC. Yes, we did have a coordinating commission before. We are revisiting history. The OECC coordinated everything from kindergarten through graduate school, supposedly, and they wrote, I think it was biannual reports to the legislature and the governor, outlining broad general goals for the educational system in the state. And they were advisory to the legislature, to the Ways and Means Committee, to the governor about budgets and policies. In that OECC was the Office of Degree Authorization. It was an appropriate place to put them. The OECC did not govern any institutions. It just coordinated and oversaw broad policy. That organization went out of business during Governor Goldschmidt's administration. The ODA was drawn into the governor's office for a number of years, and then one of the governors got a little tired of that, and it was politicizing various pieces of education more than that governor wanted, so we needed to find another home for the ODA. It was an interesting conversation. We didn't want it to be housed in any place where there was a conflict of interest governing activities such as the Oregon University system or the community college system or the Department of Education. So we looked around for where to put this interesting governmental agency, and we thought about the state police. It is a regulatory agency. We thought about the Attorney General's office. This would be a good place for it. But finally, the one place where we felt there was a good sensitivity about higher education issues and sectors would be the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, which also did not govern any particular sectors or institutions and was supposedly neutral towards all institutions. So it became housed there, and it was a key piece of that legislation that the ODA administrator would not report to the scholarship people, to the student aid people, because it really wasn't a student aid function, but we were just borrowing that commission for the ODA activity. So let's just have the ODA administrator report only to the commission. So when a commission met, they would have a session with the ODA administrator, and then they would have a longer session with the scholarship administrator or the student aid administrator. And that's the way it's been for years. As Alan points out, things have changed a little bit. Alan is housed there. The director of the commission manages his office, his operating budget, if you will. But she doesn't have the hiring and firing authority over Alan. On the one hand, that's the way we wanted it. On the other hand, it's pretty awkward. Then along comes 242. And 242 may resolve the problem for us again. It may just be that the ODA now moves back under a broader policy organization, and Alan's successor will report to the coordinating commission that you are working on. If not, it will be an ongoing awkward place to have the ODA inside the student aid operation, but nevertheless, that's the most neutral place we have. That's a little contextual background for you, Chair Dembrow. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Gary. Questions?
Just a comment. I appreciate the historical perspective. That's very valuable to me.
Thank you.
To understand, you know, that sometimes we need history to understand how we got where we are, and I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'll echo that and just reiterate a comment I've made before. That is, for me, one of the real benefits of the proposed coordinating commission is that its purview will be broad. You know, although it'll have direct it won't even have a governance authority, but, you know, its primary focus will be on the universities and the community colleges, but it will also be helping strategic kind of planning and conversations with the independent colleges, with the career colleges, all under the umbrella of, again, creating opportunity for post-secondary opportunity for young people and not so young people accessing post-secondary education.
Chair,
yes.
Matt, one further reaction to comment regarding that, arguing on behalf of the coordinating commission. You just finished testimony, and you heard Linda talking about a wonderful conference she had this past year at PCC, where she had some other community colleges, and she was looking forward to having all the community colleges come next year and participate in this. I left her my card afterwards and said, I hope you invite all the private colleges too. If you don't, people like the coordinating commission could be coordinating those kinds of things across our entire education spectrum. To the benefit of Oregon's long-term education objectives.
So, Alan, back to the conundrum that you've presented us with. How would you feel about us doing a -4 amendment, which would just focus on the the federal requirement and ignore the other piece and move forward with it? I don't know if the rest of you agree with this. I think it's best for us to pass this bill rather than try to wrap this into 242. So if we could take care of this problem, perhaps we could get this amendment by Thursday and go ahead and move this thing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that works fine. And one reason for that is the current language of 242 removes the name Office of Degree Authorization completely. The position administrator of the Office of Degree Authorization, in quotation marks, does not exist under 242 as a named officer of state government. The functions exist, and the two staff members that it has transfer over to the coordinating commission. But the whole question of who gets to appoint this person melts away on January 1 if that portion of 242 does not change. But I think the fixing the federal rule issue is the priority here, and there are other ways to deal with the rest of it in the 242 process or elsewhere. That said, I will say that the commission that I work for has made clear that they would like this change made. I think that would be if the Office of Degree Authorization were to remain within OSEC under precise current structure that it has. So I'm obligated to make clear to you their preferences here.
Thank you. And I'll be sure to send you the proposed amendments dealing with OSEC and to the rest of the committee as well. I just got a copy of them this morning. Okay, other questions for the panel? Okay, then we'll. Yes. Okay, thank you. Well, we don't need to carry over the public hearing. We'll just do a work session. Can we do that? Okay. All right. So, upon the expert advice of our committee administrator, we're going to carry over House Bill 2117 and be prepared to come back to it on Thursday. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2117. Colleagues, any questions or other business of the day?
Well, just kind of an overview, I guess, pertaining to our discussion this morning as co-chairs. We're hoping to have most of our work kind of passed out of here, if we will, by, like, say, the first week in April.
They're needing that to up above so that the committee above us can process stuff and so forth. We don't know what exactly is on the way from the Senate over here yet, but hopefully by that time we will have dealt with all of the House-originated legislation. So that's kind of our goal. Okay.
Yeah, our goal is to get any bills that we're sending to the House sent to the House by the end of next week. I'm sorry, to the Education Committee.
Exactly.
Okay, with that, I will close this public hearing, March 22nd, 2011. We are adjourned.